He had assisted. But what if he'd have taken the money and turned me in anyway, and accused me of bribery? And give up the 500 credits? I know these people better than you do, girl. But Arcadia knew that he did not know people better. Not these people. In her bed that night, she considered carefully, and knew that no bribe would have stopped a police lieutenant in the matter of catching her unless that had been planned. They didn't want to catch her, yet had made every motion of doing so nevertheless. Why? To make sure she left? And for Trantor? Were the obtuse and soft-hearted couple she was with now only a pair of tools in the hands of the Second Foundation, as helpless as she herself? They must be. Or were they? It was all so useless. How could she fight them? Whatever she did, it might only be what those terrible omnipotents wanted her to do. Yet she had to outwit them. Had to. Had to. Had to. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Chapter 16. Beginning of War. For reason or reasons unknown to members of the galaxy at the time of the era under discussion, Intergalactic Standard Time defines its fundamental unit, the second, as the time in which light travels 299,776 kilometers. 86,400 seconds are arbitrarily set equal to one intergalactic standard day, and 365 of these days to one intergalactic standard year. Why 299,776, or 86,400, or 365? Tradition, says the historian, begging the question. Because of certain and various mysterious numerical relationships, say the mystics, cultists, numerologists, metaphysicists. Because the original home planet of humanity had certain natural periods of rotation and revolution from which those relationships could be derived, say a very few. No one really knew. Nevertheless, the date on which the Foundation cruiser, the Hober Mallow, met the Kalganian squadron, headed by the Fearless, and upon refusing to allow a search party to board, was blasted into smoldering wreckage, was 185-11692-GE. That is, it was the 185th day of the 11,692nd year of the Galactic Era, which dated from the accession of the first emperor of the traditional Campbell dynasty. It was also 185-419-AS, dating from the birth of Selden, or 185-348-YF, dating from the establishment of the Foundation. On Kalgan, it was 185-56-FC, dating from the establishment of the first citizenship by the Mule. In each case, of course, for convenience, the year was so arranged as to yield the same day number regardless of the actual day upon which the era began. And in addition to all the millions of worlds of the galaxy, there were millions of local times, based on the motions of their own particular heavenly neighbors. But whichever you choose, 185, 11692, 419, 348, 56, or anything, it was this day which historians later pointed to when they spoke of the start of the Stettinian War. Yet to Dr. Darrell, it was none of these at all. It was simply and quite precisely the 32nd day since Arcadia had left Terminus. What it cost Darrell to maintain stolidity through these days was not obvious to everyone. But Elvitz Semmick thought he could guess. He was an old man, and fond of saying that his neuronic sheaths had calcified to the point where his thinking processes were stiff and unwieldy. He invited, and almost welcomed, the universal underestimation of his decaying powers by being the first to laugh at them. But his eyes were nonetheless seeing for being faded, his mind nonetheless experienced and wise for being no longer agile. He merely twisted his pinched lips and said, "Why don't you do something about it?" The sound was a physical jar to Darrell, under which he winced. He said gruffly, "Where were we?" Semmick regarded him with grave eyes. "You'd better do something about the girl." His sparse yellow teeth showed in a mouth that was open in inquiry. But Darrell replied coldly, "The question is, can you get a Sims-Molf resonator in the range required?" "Well, I said I could, and you weren't listening." "I'm sorry, Elvitt. It's like this. What we're doing now can be more important to everyone in the galaxy than the question of whether Arcadia is safe. At least to everyone but Arcadia and myself. and I'm willing to go along with the majority. How big would the resonator be? Semik looked doubtful. I don't know. You can find it somewheres in the catalogs. About how big? A ton? A pound? A block long? Oh, I thought you meant exactly. It's a little jigger. He indicated the first joint of his thumb. About that. All right. Can you do something like this? He sketched rapidly on the pad he held in his lap, then passed it over to the old physicist, who peered at it doubtfully, then chuckled. You know, the brain gets calcified when you get as old as I am. What are you trying to do? Darrell hesitated. He longed desperately, at the moment, for the physical knowledge locked in the other's brain, so that he need not put his thought into words. But the longing was useless, and he explained. Semik was shaking his head. You'd need hyper-relays, the only things that would work fast enough. Thundering lot of them. But it can be built? Well, sure. Can you get all the parts? I mean, without causing comment. In line with your general work? Semik lifted his upper lip. Can't get 50 hyper-relays. I wouldn't use that many in my whole life. We're on a defense project now. Can you think of something harmless that would use them? We've got the money. Maybe I can think of something. How small can you make the whole gadget? Hyper-relays can be had micro-size. Wiring, tubes. Space, you got a few hundred circuits there. I know. How big? Semik indicated with his hands. Too big, said Darrell. I've got to swing it from my belt. Slowly, he was crumpling his sketch into a tight ball. When it was a hard yellow grape, he dropped it into the ashtray and it was gone, with the tiny white flare of molecular decomposition. He said, Who's at your door? Semik leaned over his desk to the little milky screen above the door signal. He said, The young fellow, Anthor. Someone with him, too. Darrell scraped his chair back. Nothing about this, Semik, to the others yet. It's deadly knowledge, if they find out. And two lives are enough to risk. Peleus Anthor was a pulsing vortex of activity in Semik's office, which somehow managed to partake of the age of its occupant. In the slow turgor of the quiet room, the loose, summery sleeves of Anthor's tunic seemed still aquiver with the outer breezes. He said, Dr. Darrell, Dr. Semik, Aurum Dirige. The other man was tall, a long, straight nose that lent his thin face a saturnine appearance. Dr. Darrell held out a hand. Anthor smiled slightly. Police Lieutenant Dirige, he amplified. Then significantly, of Calgan. And Darrell turned to stare with force at the young man. Police Lieutenant Dirige of Calgan, he repeated distinctly. And you bring him here. Why? Because he was the last man on Calgan to see your daughter. Hold, man! Anthor's look of triumph was suddenly one of concern, and he was between the two, struggling violently with Darrell. Slowly, and not gently, he forced the older man back into the chair. What are you trying to do? Anthor brushed a lock of brown hair from his forehead, tossed a hip lightly upon the desk, and swung a leg thoughtfully. I thought I was bringing you good news. Darrell addressed the policeman directly. What does he mean by calling you the last man to see my daughter? Is my daughter dead? Please tell me without preliminary. His face was white with apprehension. Lieutenant Dirige said expressionlessly, Last man on Calgan was the phrase. She's not on Calgan now. I have no knowledge past that. Here, broke in Anthor. Let me put it straight. Sorry if I overplay the drama a bit, Doc. You're so inhuman about this, I forget you have feelings. In the first place, Lieutenant Dirige is one of us. He was born on Calgan, but his father was a Foundation man brought to that planet in the service of the Mule. I answer for the Lieutenant's loyalty to the Foundation. Now, I was in touch with him the day after we stopped getting the daily report from Mun. Why? Broke in Darrell fiercely. I thought it was quite decided that we were not to make a move in the matter. You were risking their lives and ours. Because, was the equally fierce retort, I've been involved in this game for longer than you. Because I know of certain contacts on Calgan of which you know nothing. Because I act from deeper knowledge, do you understand? I think you're completely mad. Will you listen? A pause, and Darrell's eyes dropped. Anthor's lips quirked into a half-smile. All right, Doc. Give me a few minutes. Tell him, Dearidge. Dearidge spoke easily. As far as I know, Dr. Darrell, your daughter is at Trantor. At least she had a ticket to Trantor at the Eastern Spaceport. She was with a trading representative from that planet who claimed she was his niece. Your daughter seems to have a queer collection of relatives, Doctor. That was the second uncle she had in a period of 2 weeks, huh? The Trantorian even tried to bribe me. Probably thinks that's why they got away. He smiled grimly at the thought. Ah, was she? Unharmed, as far as I could see. Frightened. I don't blame her for that. The whole department was after her. I still don't know why. Darrell drew a breath for what seemed the first time in several minutes. He was conscious of the trembling of his hands and controlled them with an effort. Then she's all right, this trading representative. Who was he? Go back to him. What part does he play in it? I don't know. Do you know anything about Trantor? I lived there once. It's an agricultural world now. Exports animal fodder and grains mostly. High quality. They sell them all over the galaxy. There are a dozen or two farm cooperatives on the planet, and each has its representatives overseas. Shrewd sons of guns, too. I knew this one's record. He'd been on Kalgan before, usually with his wife. Perfectly honest, perfectly harmless. Said Anthor. Arcadia was born on Trantor, wasn't she, Doc? Darrell nodded. It hangs together, you see. She wanted to go away, quickly and far, and Trantor would suggest itself. Don't you think so? Darrell said. Why not back here? Perhaps she was being pursued, and felt that she had to double off in a new angle, huh? Dr. Darrell lacked the heart to question further. Well, then, let her be safe on Trantor, or as safe as one could be anywhere in this dark and horrible galaxy. He groped toward the door, felt Anthor's light touch on his sleeve, and stopped, but did not turn. Mind if I go home with you, Doc? You're welcome, was the automatic response. By evening, the exterior-most reaches of Dr. Darrell's personality, the ones that made immediate contact with other people, had solidified once more. He had refused to eat his evening meal, and had instead, with feverish insistence, returned to the inchward advance into the intricate mathematics of encephalographic analysis. It was not till nearly midnight that he entered the living room again. Peleus Anthor was still there, twiddling at the controls of the video. The footsteps behind him caused him to glance over his shoulder. Hi, aren't you in bed yet? I've been spending hours on the video, trying to get something other than bulletins. Seems the F.S. Hober-Mallow is delayed in course and hasn't been heard from. Really? What do they suspect? What do you think? Kalganian skullduggery. There are reports that Kalganian vessels were sighted in the general space sector in which the Hober-Mallow was last heard from. Darrell shrugged, and Anthor rubbed his forehead doubtfully. Look, Doc, he said. Why don't you go to Trantor? Why should I? Because you're no good to us here. You're not yourself. You can't be. And you could accomplish a purpose by going to Trantor, too. The old Imperial Library, with the complete records of the proceedings of the Selden Commissioner there. No! The library has been picked clean, and it hasn't helped anyone. It helped Ebling Miz once. How do you know? Yes, he said he found the second foundation, and my mother killed him 5 seconds later as the only way to keep him from unwittingly revealing its location to the mule. But in doing so, she also, you realize, made it impossible ever to tell whether Miz really did know the location. After all, no one else has ever been able to deduce the truth from those records. Ebling Miz, if you'll remember, was working under the driving impetus of the mule's mind. I know that, too. But Miz's mind was, by that very token, in an abnormal state. Do you and I know anything about the properties of a mind under the emotional control of another? About its abilities and shortcomings? In any case, I will not go to Trantor. Anthor frowned. Well, why the vehemence? I merely suggested it as... Well, by space, I don't understand you. You look 10 years older. You're obviously having a hellish time of it. You're not doing anything of value here. If I were you, I'd go and get the girl. Exactly. It's what I want to do, too. That's why I won't do it. Look, Anthor, try to understand. You're playing, we're both playing, with something completely beyond our powers to fight. In cold blood, if you have any, you know that. Whatever you may think in your moments of quixoticism. For 50 years we've known that the Second Foundation is the real descendant and pupil of Seldonian mathematics. What that means, and you know that too, is that nothing in the galaxy happens which does not play a part in their reckoning. To us, all life is a series of accidents, to be met with by improvisations. To them, all life is purposive and should be met by precalculation. But they have their weakness. Their work is statistical, and only the mass action of humanity is truly inevitable. Now, how I play a part as an individual in the foreseen course of history, I don't know. Perhaps I have no definite part, since the plan leaves individuals to indeterminacy and free will. But I am important, and they, you understand, may at least have calculated my probable reaction. So I distrust my impulses, my desires, my probable reactions. I would rather present them with an improbable reaction. I will stay here, despite the fact that I yearn very desperately to leave. No, because I yearn very desperately to leave. The young man smiled sourly. You don't know your own mind as well as they might. Suppose that, knowing you, they might count on what you think. Merely think is the improbable reaction, simply by knowing in advance what your line of reasoning would be. In that case, there is no escape. For if I follow the reasoning you have just outlined and go to Trantor, they may have foreseen that too. There is an endless cycle of double, 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 double crosses. No matter how far I follow that cycle, I can only either go or stay. The intricate act of luring my daughter halfway across the galaxy cannot be meant to make me stay where I am, since I would most certainly have stayed if they had done nothing. It can only be to make me move, and so I will stay. Besides, Anthor, not everything bears the breath of the Second Foundation. Not all events are the results of their puppeteering. They may have had nothing to do with Arcadia's leave-taking, and she may be safe on Trantor when all the rest of us are dead. No, said Anthor sharply. Now you are off the track. You have an alternative interpretation? I have, if you'll listen. Oh, go ahead. I don't lack patience. Well, then, how well do you know your own daughter? How well can any individual know any other? Obviously, my knowledge is inadequate. So is mine on that basis, perhaps even more so. But at least I viewed her with fresh eyes. Item one, she is a ferocious little romantic, the only child of an ivory tower academician, growing up in an unreal world of video and book film adventure. She lives in a weird, self-constructed fantasy of espionage and intrigue. Item two, she's intelligent about it. Intelligent enough to outwit us, at any rate. She planned carefully to overhear our first conference and succeeded. She planned carefully to go to Calgan with Mun and succeeded. Item three, she has an unholy hero worship of her grandmother, your mother, who defeated the mule. I'm right so far, I think? All right, then. Now, unlike you, I've received a complete report from Lieutenant DeRidge. And in addition, my sources of information on Calgan are rather complete, and all sources check. We know, for instance, that Homir Mun, in conference with the Lord of Calgan, was refused admission to the Mule's Palace, and that this refusal was suddenly abrogated after Arcadia had spoken to Lady Calia, the First Citizen's very good friend. Daryl interrupted. And how do you know all this? For one thing, Mun was interviewed by DeRidge as a part of the police campaign to locate Arcadia. Naturally, we have a complete transcript of the questions and answers. And take Lady Calia herself. It is rumored that she has lost Stetton's interest, but the rumor isn't borne out by facts. She not only remains unreplaced, is not only able to mediate the Lord's refusal to Mun into an acceptance, but can even engineer Arcadia's escape openly. Why, a dozen of the soldiers about Stetton's executive mansion testified that they were seen together on the last evening. Yet she remains unpunished. This, despite the fact that Arcadia was searched for with every appearance of diligence. But what is your conclusion from all this torrent of ill connection? That Arcadia's escape was arranged. As I said, with this addition, that Arcadia must have known it was arranged. That Arcadia, the bright little girl who saw cabals everywhere, saw this one and followed your own type of reasoning. They wanted her to return to the Foundation, and so she went to Trantor instead. But why Trantor? Well, why? Because that is where Beta, her idolized grandmother, escaped when she was in flight. Consciously or unconsciously, Arcadia imitated that. I wonder, then, if Arcadia was fleeing the same enemy. The mule? Asked Darrell with polite sarcasm. Of course not. I mean by the enemy, a mentality that she could not fight. She was running from the Second Foundation, or such influence thereof as could be found on Calgan. What influence is this you speak of? Do you expect Calgan to be immune from that ubiquitous menace? We have both come to the conclusion somehow that Arcadia's escape was arranged, right? She was searched for and found, but deliberately allowed to slip away by DeRidge. By DeRidge, do you understand? But how was that? Because he was our man. But how did they know that? Were they counting on him to be a traitor, huh, Doc? Now you're saying that they honestly meant to recapture her. Frankly, you're tiring me a bit, Anthor. Finish your say. I want to go to bed. My say is quickly finished. Anthor reached for a small group of photo records in his inner pocket. It was the familiar wigglings of the encephalograph. DeRidge's brainwaves, Anthor said casually. Taken since he returned. It was quite visible to Darrell's naked eye, and his face was gray when he looked up. He is controlled. Exactly. He allowed Arcadia to escape, not because he was our man, but because he was the Second Foundation's. Even after he knew she was going to Trentor, and not to Terminus. Anthor shrugged. He had been geared to let her go. There was just no way he could modify that. He was only a tool, you see. It was just that Arcadia followed the least probable course, and is probably safe. Or at least safe until such time as the Second Foundation can modify the plans to take into account this changed state of affairs. He paused. The little signal light on the video set was flashing. On an independent circuit, it signified the presence of emergency news. Darrell saw it too, and with the mechanical movement of long habit, turned on the video. They broke in upon the middle of a sentence, but before its completion, they knew that the Hober Mallow, or the wreck thereof, had been found, and that for the first time in nearly half a century, the Foundation was again at war. Anthor's jaw was set in a hard line. All right, Doc, you heard that. Calgan is attacked, and Calgan is under the control of the Second Foundation. Will you follow your daughter's lead and move to Trantor? No, I will risk it. Here. Dr. Darrell, you are not as intelligent as your daughter. I wonder how far you can be trusted. His long, level stare held Darrell for a moment, and then without a word, he left. And Darrell was left in uncertainty and almost despair. Unheeded, the video was a medley of excited sight sound, as it described in nervous detail the first hour of the war between Calgan and the Foundation. Chapter 17. War. The mayor of the Foundation brushed futilely at the picket fence of hair that rimmed his skull. He sighed. The years that we have wasted, the chances we have thrown away. I make no recriminations, Dr. Darrell, but we deserve defeat. Darrell said quietly, I see no reason for lack of confidence in events, sir. Lack of confidence? Lack of confidence? By the galaxy, Dr. Darrell, on what would you base any other attitude? Come here. He half-led, half-forced Darrell toward the limpid ovoid, cradled gracefully on its tiny force-field support. At a touch of the mayor's hand, it glowed within, an accurate three-dimensional model of the galactic double spiral. In yellow, said the mayor excitedly, we have that region of space under Foundation control. In red, that under Calgan. What Darrell saw was a crimson sphere resting within a stretching yellow fist, that surrounded it on all sides but that toward the center of the galaxy. Galactography, said the mayor, is our greatest enemy. Our admirals make no secret of our almost helpless strategic position. Observe, the enemy has inner lines of communication. He is concentrated. He can meet us on all sides with equal ease. He can defend himself with minimum force. We are expanded. The average distance between inhabited systems within the Foundation is nearly three times that within Calgan. To go from Santani to Locris, for instance, is a voyage of 2,500 parsecs for us, but only 800 parsecs for them, if we remain within our respective territories. Darrell said, I understand all that, sir. And you do not understand that it may mean defeat? There is more than distance to war. I say we cannot lose. It is quite impossible. And why do you say that? Because of my own interpretation of the Selden plan. Oh. The mayor's lips twisted, and the hands behind his back flapped one within the other. Then you rely, too, on the mystical help of the Second Foundation? No, merely on the help of inevitability, and of courage and persistence. And yet behind his easy confidence, he wondered, What if Anthor were right, and Kalgan were a direct tool of the mental wizards? What if it was their purpose to defeat and destroy the Foundation? No, it made no sense. And yet, he smiled bitterly. All was the same. All was that peering and peering through the opaque granite, which to the enemy was so transparent. Nor were the galactographic verities of the situation lost upon Stettin. The Lord of Kalgan stood before a twin of the galactic model which the mayor and Daryl had inspected. Except that where the mayor frowned, Stettin smiled. His admiral's uniform glistered imposingly upon his massive figure. The crimson sash of the Order of the Mule, awarded him by the former First Citizen, whom 6 months later he had replaced somewhat forcefully, spanned his chest diagonally from right shoulder to waist. The silver star with double comets and swords sparkled brilliantly upon his left shoulder. He addressed the 6 men of his general staff, whose uniforms were only less grandiloquent than his own, and his first minister as well, thin and gray, a darkling cobweb lost in the brightness. Stettin said, I think the decisions are clear. We can afford to wait. To them, every day of delay will be another blow at their morale. If they attempt to defend all portions of their realm, they will be spread thin, and we can strike through in 2 simultaneous thrusts, here and here. He indicated the directions on the galactic model. 2 lances of pure white, shooting through the yellow fist from the red ball it enclosed, cutting terminus off on either side in a tight arc. In such a manner, we cut their fleet into 3 parts, which can be defeated in detail. If they concentrate, they give up 2/3 of their dominions voluntarily, and will probably risk rebellion. The First Minister's thin voice alone seeped through the hush that followed. In 6 months, he said, the Foundation will grow 6 months stronger. Their resources are greater, as we all know. Their navy is numerically stronger. Their manpower is virtually inexhaustible. Perhaps a quick thrust would be safer. He was easily the least influential voice in the room. Lord Stettin smiled and made a flat gesture with his hand. The 6 months or a year, if necessary, will cost us nothing. The men of the Foundation cannot prepare. They are ideologically incapable of it. It is in their very philosophy to believe that the Second Foundation will save them. But not this time, huh? The men in the room stirred uneasily. You lack confidence, I believe, said Stettin frigidly. Is it necessary once again to describe the reports of our agents in Foundation territory, or to repeat the findings of Mr. Homer Munn, the Foundation agent now in our, service? Let us adjourn, gentlemen. Stettin returned to his private chambers with a fixed smile still on his face. He sometimes wondered about this Homer Munn, a queer water-spined fellow who certainly did not bear out his early promise. And yet he crawled with interesting information that carried conviction with it, particularly when Kallia was present. His smile broadened. That fat fool had her uses after all. At least she got more with her wheedling out of Munn than he could, and with less trouble. Why not give her to Munn? He frowned. Kallia. She and her stupid jealousy. Space, if he still had the Daryl girl. Why hadn't he ground her skull to powder for that? He couldn't quite put his finger on the reason. Maybe because she got along with Munn, and he needed Munn. It was Munn, for instance, who had demonstrated that, at least in the belief of the Mule, there was no Second Foundation. His admirals needed that assurance. He would have liked to make the proofs public, but it was better to let the Foundation believe in their non-existent help. Was it actually Kallia who had pointed that out? That's right, she had said... Oh, nonsense, she couldn't have said anything. And yet, he shook his head to clear it, and passed on. Chapter 18. Ghost of a World. Trantor was a world in dregs and rebirth, set like a faded jewel in the midst of the bewildering crowd of suns at the center of the galaxy. In the heaps and clusters of stars piled high with aimless prodigality, it alternately dreamed of past and future. Time had been when the insubstantial ribbons of control had stretched out from its metal coating to the very edges of stardom. It had been a single city, housing 400 billion administrators, the mightiest capital that had ever been, until the decay of the empire eventually reached it, and in the great sack of a century ago, its drooping powers had been bent back upon themselves and broken forever. In the blasting ruin of death, the metal shell that circled the planet wrinkled and crumpled into an aching mock of its own grandeur. This book is continued on cassette number 7. In the blasting ruin of death, the metal shell that circled the planet wrinkled and crumpled into an aching mock of its own grandeur. The survivors tore up the metal plating and sold it to other planets for seed and cattle. The soil was uncovered once more, and the planet returned to its beginnings. In the spreading areas of primitive agriculture, it forgot its intricate and colossal past, or would have, but for the still mighty shards that heaped their massive ruins toward the sky in bitter and dignified silence. Arcadia watched the metal rim of the horizon with a stirring of the heart. The village in which the Palvers lived was but a huddle of houses to her, small and primitive. The fields that surrounded it were golden yellow, wheat-clogged tracts. But there, just past the reaching point, was the memory of the past, still glowing in unrusted splendor, and burning with fire where the sun of Trantor caught it in gleaming highlights. She had been there once, during the months since she had arrived at Trantor. She had climbed onto the smooth, unjointed pavement, and ventured into the silent, dust-streaked structures, where the light entered through the jags of broken walls and partitions. It had been solidified heartache. It had been blasphemy. She had left, clangingly, running until her feet pounded softly on earth once more. And then she could only look back longingly. She dared not disturb that mighty brooding once more. Somewhere on this world, she knew, she had been born, near the old Imperial Library, which was the veriest Trantor of Trantor. It was the sacred of the sacred, the holy of holies. Of all the world, it alone had survived the great sack, and for a century it had remained complete and untouched, defiant of the universe. There, Harry Seldon and his group had woven their unimaginable web. There, Ebling Miz pierced the secret and sat numbed in his vast surprise until he was killed to prevent the secret from going further. There, at the Imperial Library, her grandparents had lived for 10 years until the mule died and they could return to the reborn foundation. There, at the Imperial Library, her own father returned with his bride to find the second foundation once again, but failed. There she had been born, and there her mother had died. She would have liked to visit the library, but Preem Palver shook his round head. "It's thousands of miles, Arcady, and there's so much to do here. Besides, it's not good to bother there. You know, it's a shrine." But Arcadia knew that he had no desire to visit the library, that it was a case of the mule's palace over again. There was this superstitious fear on the part of the pygmies of the present for the relics of the giants of the past. Yet it would have been horrible to feel a grudge against the funny little man for that. She had been on Trantor now for nearly 3 months, and in all that time, he and she, Papa and Mama, had been wonderful to her. And what was her return? Why, to involve them in the common ruin? Had she warned them that she was marked for destruction, perhaps? No, she let them assume the deadly role of protectors. Her conscience panged unbearably, yet what choice had she? She stepped reluctantly down the stairs to breakfast. The voices reached her. Preem Palver had tucked the napkin down his shirt collar with a twist of his plump neck, and had reached for his poached eggs with an uninhibited satisfaction. "I was down in the city yesterday, Mama," he said, wielding his fork and nearly drowning the words with a capacious mouthful. "And what is down in the city, Papa?" asked Mama indifferently, sitting down, looking sharply about the table, and rising again for the salt. "Ah, not so good. A ship came in from out Calgan way with newspapers from there. It's war there." "War? So? Well, let them break their heads if they have no more sense inside. Did your paycheck come yet?" "Papa, I'm telling you again. You warn old man Kosker this isn't the only cooperative in the world. It's bad enough they pay you what I'm ashamed to tell my friends, but at least on time they could be. Time, shmime, said Papa irritably. Don't make me silly talk at breakfast. It should choke me each bite in the throat. And he wreaked havoc among the buttered toast as he said it. He added somewhat more moderately, The fighting is between Calgan and the Foundation, and for 2 months they've been at it. His hands lunged at one another in mock representation of a space fight. And what's doing? Bad for the Foundation. Well, you saw Calgan, all soldiers. They were ready. The Foundation was not, and so, poof! And suddenly Mama laid down her fork and hissed, Fool! Huh? Dumbhead! Your big mouth is always moving and wagging. She was pointing quickly, and when Papa looked over his shoulder, there was Arcadia, frozen in the doorway. She said, The Foundation is at war? Papa looked helplessly at Mama, then nodded. And they're losing? Again the nod. Arcadia felt the unbearable catch in her throat and slowly approached the table. Is it over? She whispered. Over? Repeated Papa with false heartiness. Who said it was over? In war, lots of things can happen. And sit down, darling, said Mama soothingly. No one should talk before breakfast. You're not in a healthy condition with no food in the stomach. But Arcadia ignored her. Are the Calganians on Terminus? No, said Papa seriously. The news is from last week, and Terminus is still fighting. This is honest. I'm telling the truth. And the Foundation is still strong. Do you want me to get you the newspapers? Yes. She read them over what she could eat of her breakfast, and her eyes blurred as she read. Santani and Corell were gone, without a fight. A squadron of the Foundation's navy had been trapped in the sparsely sunned Ifni sector and wiped out to almost the last ship. And now the Foundation was back to the Four Kingdom Core, the original realm, which had been built up under Salvor Hardin, the first mayor. But still it fought, and still there might be a chance. And whatever happened, she must inform her father. She must somehow reach his ear. She must. But how? With a war in the way. She asked Papa after breakfast, Are you going out on a new mission soon, Mr. Palver? Papa was on the large chair on the front lawn, sunning himself. A fat cigar smoldered between his plump fingers, and he looked like a beatific pug dog. A mission, he repeated lazily. Who knows? It's a nice vacation, and my leave isn't up. Why talk about new missions? You're restless, Arcady? Me? No, I like it here. You're very good to me, you and Mrs. Palver. He waved his hand at her, brushing away her words. Arcadia said, I was thinking about the war. But don't think about it. What can you do? If it's something you can't help, why hurt yourself over it? But I was thinking that the Foundation has lost most of its farming worlds. They're probably rationing food there. Papa looked uncomfortable. Don't worry, it'll be all right. She scarcely listened. I wish I could carry food to them, that's what. You know, after the mule died and the Foundation rebelled, Terminus was just about isolated for a time, and General Han Pritcher, who succeeded the mule for a while, was laying siege to it. Food was running awfully low, and my father says that his father told him that they had only dry amino acid concentrates that tasted terrible. Why, one egg cost 200 credits, and then they broke the siege just in time and food ships came through from Santani. Must have been an awful time. Probably it's happening all over, now. There was a pause, and then Arcadia said, You know, I'll bet the Foundation would be willing to pay smugglers' prices for food now. Double and triple, and more. Gee, if any cooperative, for instance, here on Trantor, took over the job, they might lose some ships, but I'll bet they'd be war millionaires before it was over. The Foundation traders in the old days used to do that all the time. There'd be a war, so they'd sell whatever was needed bad and take their chances. Golly, they used to make as much as $2 million out of one trip. Profit! That was just out of what they could carry on one ship, too. Papa stirred. His cigar had gone out, unnoticed. A deal for food, huh? But the Foundation is so far away. Oh, I know. I guess you couldn't do it from here. If you took a regular liner, you probably couldn't get closer than Messena or Smushik. And after that, you'd have to hire a small scout ship or something to slip you through the lines. Papa's hand brushed at his hair as he calculated. 2 weeks later, arrangements for the mission were completed. Mama railed for most of the time. First, at the incurable obstinacy with which he courted suicide. Then, at the incredible obstinacy with which he refused to allow her to accompany him. Papa said, "Mama, why do you act like an old lady? I can't take you. It's a man's work. What do you think a war is? Fun? Child's play? Then why do you go? Are you a man, you old fool, with a leg and a half an arm in the grave? Let some of the young ones go, not a fat, bald head like you." "I'm not a bald head," retorted Papa with dignity. "I got yet lots of hair. And why should it not be me that gets the commission? Why a young fellow? Listen, this could mean millions." She knew that, and she subsided. Arcadia saw him once before he left. She said, "Are you going to Terminus?" "Why not? You say yourself they need bread and rice and potatoes. Well, I'll make a deal with them, and they'll get it."
"Well, then, just one thing. If you're going to Terminus, could you... would you see my father?"
And Papa's face crinkled and seemed to melt into sympathy.
"Oh, and I have to wait for you to tell me. Sure, I'll see him. I'll tell him you're safe and everything's okay, and when the war is over, I'll bring you back."
"Thanks. I'll tell you how to find him. His name is Dr. Toran Darrow, and he lives in Stanmark. That's just outside Terminus City, and you can get a little commuting plane that goes there. We're at 55 Channel Drive."
"Wait, and I'll write that down."
No. Arcadia's arm shot out. "You mustn't write anything down. You must remember and find him without anybody's help."
Papa looked puzzled. Then he shrugged his shoulders.
"All right, then. It's 55 Channel Drive in Stanmark, outside Terminus City, and you commute there by plane. All right?"
"One other thing."
"Yes?"
"Would you tell him something from me?"
"Sure."
"I want to whisper it to you."
He leaned his plump cheek toward her, and a little whispered sound passed from one to the other. Papa's eyes were round.
"That's what you want me to say? But it doesn't make sense."
"He'll know what you mean. Just say I sent it, and that I said he would know what it means. And you say it exactly the way I told you, no different. You won't forget it?"
"How can I forget it? 5 little words. Look..."
No.
She hopped up and down in the intensity of her feelings.
"Don't repeat it. Don't ever repeat it to anyone. Forget all about it except to my father. Promise me."
Papa shrugged again.
"I promise. All right."
"All right," she said, mournfully.
And as he passed down the drive to where the air taxi waited to take him to the spaceport, she wondered if she had signed his death warrant. She wondered if she would ever see him again. She scarcely dared to walk into the house again to face the good, kind Mama. Maybe when it was all over, she had better kill herself for what she had done to them. Chapter 19. End of War. Quariston, Battle of, fought on 9-17-377 FE, between the forces of the Foundation and those of Lord Stetton of Calgan. It was the last battle of consequence during the Interregnum. Encyclopedia Galactica. Joe Turbor, in his new role of war correspondent, found his bulk encased in a naval uniform, and rather liked it. He enjoyed being back on the air, and some of the fierce helplessness of the futile fight against the Second Foundation left him in the excitement of another sort of fight with substantial ships and ordinary men. To be sure, the Foundation's fight had not been remarkable for victories, but it was still possible to be philosophic about the matter. After 6 months, the hard core of the Foundation was untouched, and the hard core of the fleet was still in being. With the new addition since the start of the war, it was almost as strong numerically, and stronger technically, than before the defeat at Ifni. And meanwhile, planetary defenses were being strengthened, the armed forces better trained, administrative efficiency was having some of the water squeezed out of it, and much of the Kalganians' conquering fleet was being wallowed down through the necessity of occupying the conquered territory. At the moment, Turbor was with the Third Fleet in the outer reaches of the Anacreonian sector. In line with his policy of making this a little man's war, he was interviewing Fennel Lemore, Engineer Third Class, Volunteer.
Tell us a little about yourself, sailor, said Turbor.
Ain't much to tell.
Lemore shuffled his feet and allowed a faint, bashful smile to cover his face.
as though he could see all the millions that undoubtedly could see him at the moment. "I'm a Locrian. Got a job in an air car factory. Section head and good pay. I'm married. Got two kids, both girls. Say, I couldn't say hello to them, could I, in case they're listening?" "Go ahead, sailor. The video is all yours."
"Gosh, thanks."
He burbled. "Hello, Miller. In case you're listening, I'm fine. Is Sonny all right? And Toma? I think of you all the time, and maybe I'll be back on furlough after we get back to port. I got your food parcel, but I'm sending it back. We get our regular mess, but they say the civilians are a little tight. I guess that's all. I'll look her up the next time I'm on Locris, sailor, and make sure she's not short of food. Okay?" The young man smiled broadly and nodded his head. "Thank you, Mr. Turbor. I'd appreciate that." "All right. Suppose you tell us, then. You're a volunteer, aren't you?"
"Sure am. If anyone picks a fight with me, I don't have to wait for anyone to drag me in. I joined up the day I heard about the Hobermallow."
"That's a fine spirit. Have you seen much action? I notice you're wearing two battle stars." The sailor spat. "Those weren't battles, they were chases. The Kalganians don't fight unless they have odds of 5-1 or better in their favor. Even then, they just edge in and try to cut us up ship by ship. A cousin of mine was at Ifni, and he was on a ship that got away, the old Ebling Miz. He says it was the same there. They had their main fleet against just a wing division of ours, and down to where we had only 5 ships left, they kept stalking instead of fighting. We got twice as many of their ships at that fight."
"Then you think we're going to win the war?"
"Sure bet, now that we aren't retreating. Even if things got too bad, that's when I'd expect the Second Foundation to step in. We still got the Selden plan, and they know it, too."
Turboy's lips curled a bit.
"You're counting on the Second Foundation, then?"
The answer came out with honest surprise.
"Well, doesn't everyone?"
Junior Officer Tipulum stepped into Turboy's room after the visicast. He shoved a cigarette at the correspondent and knocked his cap back to a perilous balance on the occiput.
"We picked up a prisoner," he said.
"Yes?"
"Little crazy fella. Claims to be a neutral. Diplomatic immunity, no less. I don't think they know what to do with him. His name's Palver, something like that. And he says he's from Trantor. Don't know what in space he's doing in a war zone."
But Turbor had swung to a sitting position on his bunk, and the nap he had been about to take was forgotten. He remembered quite well his last interview with Daryl, the day after war had been declared, and he was shoving off.
"Preem Palver," he said.
It was a statement. Tipulum paused and let the smoke trickle out the sides of his mouth.
"Yeah," he said. "How in space did you know?"
"Never mind. Can I see him?"
"Space? I can't say. The old man has him in his own room for questioning. Everyone figures he's a spy."
"You tell the old man that I know him, if he's who he claims he is. I'll take the responsibility." Captain Dixell, on the flagship of the Third Fleet, watched unremittingly at the Grand Detector. No ship could avoid being a source of subatomic radiation, not even if it were lying an inert mass, and each focal point of such radiation was a little sparkle in the three-dimensional field. Each one of the Foundation's ships were accounted for, and no sparkle was left over, now that the little spy who claimed to be a neutral had been picked up. For a while, that outside ship had created a stir in the captain's quarters. The tactics might have needed changing on short notice. As it was...
"Are you sure you have it?" he asked.
Commander Sen nodded. "I will take my squadron through hyperspace, radius 10.00 parsecs. Theta... 268.52 degrees. Phi, 84.15 degrees. Return to origin at 13:30. Total absence, 11.83 hours.
Right. Now, we are going to count on pinpoint return as regards both space and time. Understand?"
"Yes, Captain." He looked at his wristwatch.
"My ships will be ready by 0140.
"Good," said Captain Dixell. The Kalganian squadron was not within detector range now, but they would be soon. There was independent information to that effect. Without Sen's squadron, the Foundation forces would be badly outnumbered. But the captain was quite confident. Quite confident. Preem Palver looked sadly about him. First at the tall, skinny admiral, then at the others, everyone in uniform. And now at this last one, big and stout, with his collar open and no tie. Not like the rest,
who said he wanted to speak to him. Joel Terbor was saying, "I am perfectly aware, Admiral, of the serious possibilities involved here, but I tell you that if I can be allowed to speak to him for a few minutes, I may be able to settle the current uncertainty. Is there any reason why you can't question him before me?" Terbor pursed his lips and looked stubborn. "Admiral," he said, "while I have been attached to your ships, the Third Fleet has received an excellent press. You may station men outside the door if you like, and you may return in 5 minutes. But meanwhile, humor me a bit, and your public relations will not suffer. Do you understand me?" He did. Then Terbor, in the isolation that followed, turned to Palver and said, "Quickly, what is the name of the girl you abducted?" And Palver could simply stare round-eyed and shake his head. "No nonsense," said Terbor. "If you do not answer, you will be a spy, and spies are blasted without trial in wartime." "Arcadia Darrell," gasped Palver. "Well, all right then. Is she safe?" Palver nodded. "You had better be sure of that, or it won't be well for you." "She is in good health, perfectly safe," said Palver, palely. The Admiral returned. "Well, the man, sir, is not a spy. You may believe what he tells you. I vouch for him." "That's so." The Admiral frowned. "Then he represents an agricultural cooperative on Trantor that wants to make a trade treaty with Terminus for a delivery of grains and potatoes." "Well, all right. But he can't leave now." "Why not?" asked Palver quickly. "Because we're in the middle of a battle. After it is over, assuming we're still alive, we'll take you to Terminus." The Kalganian fleet that spanned through space detected the Foundation ships from an incredible distance and were themselves detected. Like little fireflies in each other's grand detectors, they closed in across the emptiness. And the Foundation's admiral frowned and said, "This must be their main push. Look at the numbers." Then, "They won't stand up before us, though. Not if Sen's detachment can be counted on." Commander Sen had left hours before, at the first detection of the coming enemy. There was no way of altering the plan now. It worked or it didn't, but the admiral felt quite comfortable, as did the officers, as did the men. Again, watch the fireflies. Like a deadly ballet dance, in precise formations they sparked. The Foundation fleet edged slowly backwards. Hours passed, and the fleet veered slowly off, teasing the advancing enemy slightly off course, then more so. In the minds of the dictators of the battle plan, there was a certain volume of space that must be occupied by the Kalganian ships. Out from that volume crept the Foundationers. Into it slipped the Kalganians. Those that passed out again were attacked, suddenly and fiercely. Those that stayed within were not touched. It all depended on the reluctance of the ships of Lord Stettin to take the initiative themselves, on their willingness to remain where none attacked. Captain Dixell stared frigidly at his wristwatch. It was 13:10. "We've got 20 minutes," he said. The lieutenant at his side nodded tensely. "Looks all right so far, Captain. We've got more than 90% of them boxed. If we can keep them that way..." "Yes, if..." The Foundation ships were drifting forward again, very slowly. Not quick enough to urge a Kalganian retreat, and just quickly enough to discourage a Kalganian advance. They preferred to wait. And the minutes passed. At 13:25, the Admiral's buzzer sounded in 75 ships of the Foundation's line, and they built up to a maximum acceleration towards the front plane of the Kalganian fleet, itself 300 strong. Kalganian shields flared into action, and the vast energy beams flicked out. Every one of the 300 concentrated in the same direction, towards their mad attackers who bored down relentlessly, uncaringly, and... At 13:30, 50 ships under Commander Sen appeared from nowhere, in one single bound through hyperspace to a calculated spot at a calculated time, and were spaced in tearing fury at the unprepared Kalganian rear. The trap worked perfectly. The Kalganians still had numbers on their side, but they were in no mood to count. Their first effort was to escape, and the formation, once broken, was only the more vulnerable, as the enemy ships bumbled into one another's path. After a while, it took on the proportions of a rat hunt. Of 300 Kalganian ships, the core and pride of their fleet, some 60 or less many in a state of near hopeless disrepair, reached Calgan once more. The Foundation loss was 8 ships out of a total of 125. Preem Palver landed on Terminus at the height of the celebration. He found the Fuhrer distracting, but before he left the planet, he had accomplished 2 things and received 1 request. The 2 things accomplished were, 1, the conclusion of an agreement whereby Palver's cooperative was to deliver 20 shiploads of certain foodstuffs per month for the next year at a war price, without, thanks to the recent battle, a corresponding war risk, and 2, the transfer to Dr. Darrell of Arcadia's 5 short words. For a startled moment, Darrell had stared wide-eyed at him, and then he had to make his request. It was to carry an answer back to Arcadia. Palver liked it. It was a simple answer and made sense. It was, "Come back now. There won't be any danger." Lord Stetton was in raging frustration. To watch his every weapon break in his hands, to feel the firm fabric of his military might part like the rotten thread it suddenly turned out to be, would have turned phlegmaticism itself into flowing lava. And yet he was helpless and knew it. He hadn't really slept well in weeks. He hadn't shaved in 3 days. He had canceled all audiences. His admirals were left to themselves, and none knew better than the Lord of Calgan that very little time and no further defeats need elapse before he would have to contend with internal rebellion. Lev Mirus, First Minister, was no help. He stood there, calm and indecently old, with his thin, nervous fingers stroking, as always, the wrinkled line from nose to chin.
"Well?" shouted Stetton at him. "Contribute something! We stand here defeated, do you understand? Defeated! And why? I don't know why! There you have it. I don't know why! Do you know why?"
"I think so," said Mirus calmly. "Treason." The word came out softly, and other words followed as softly. "You've known of treason, and you've kept quiet. You served the fool I ejected from the First Citizenship, and you think you can serve whatever foul rat replaces me. If you have acted so, I will extract your entrails for it and burn them before your living eyes." Mirus was unmoved.
"I have tried to fill you with my own doubts, not once, but many times. I have dinned it in your ears, and you have preferred the advice of others because it stuffed your ego better. Matters have turned out not as I feared, but even worse. If you do not care to listen now, say so, sir, and I shall leave, and in due course deal with your successor, whose first act, no doubt, will be to sign a treaty of peace."
Stetton stared at him red-eyed, enormous fists slowly clenching and unclenching.
"Speak, you gray slug. Speak!"
"I have told you often, sir, that you are not the mule. You may control ships and guns, but you cannot control the minds of your subjects. Are you aware, sir, of who it is you are fighting? You fight the Foundation, which is never defeated. The Foundation, which is protected by the Selden Plan. The Foundation, which is destined to form a new empire."
"There is no plan, no longer. Mun has said so."
"Then Mun is wrong. And if he were right, what then? You and I, sir, are not the people. The men and women of Calgan and its subject worlds believe utterly and deeply in the Selden Plan, as do all the inhabitants of this end of the galaxy. Nearly 400 years of history teach the fact that the Foundation cannot be beaten. Neither the kingdoms, nor the warlords, nor the old galactic empire itself could do it."
"The mule did it."
"Exactly. And he was beyond calculation. And you are not. What is worse, the people know that you are not. So your ships go into battle fearing defeat in some unknown way. The insubstantial fabric of the plan hangs over them so that they are cautious and look before they attack and wonder a little too much. While on the other side, that same insubstantial fabric fills the enemy with confidence, removes fear, maintains morale in the face of early defeats. Why not? The Foundation has always been defeated at first, and has always won in the end. And your own morale, sir. You stand everywhere on enemy territory. Your own dominions have not been invaded.
are still not in danger of invasion. Yet you are defeated. You don't believe in the possibility even of victory, because you know there is none. Stoop, then, or you will be beaten to your knees. Stoop voluntarily, and you may save